So the topic that Volchek is going to discuss today is one that began actually at the same institution at which he currently works, which is Memorial Sloan Kettering in the 1890s was a man by the
name. I have a picture of him, yeah.
So I'm not going to tell you about that because it's part of the talk. But the consummation, devoutly to be wished, of immunologists, cancer specialists for more than 100 years has been, why can't we use the immune system to get rid of tumors? After all, tumors have mutations.
The invitation to speak. I wanted to tell you a little bit about myself. So I am a product of New York City Public Schools, and so I am thrilled to be part of this, and I applaud all of you for the efforts that you're making to learn additional up-to-date science that you can share with the next generation. I think that your job is a really important one. I'm the parent of a 14-year-old being educated here in New York, so I am very much in awe of what students are learning now in high school and in junior high school, and it's amazing how quickly the curricula have come up to date compared to, you know, when I went to school. So I really couldn't be more thrilled and happy to be here to be part of this effort, which I think is so important. As Sam said, we're here to talk about how to use the immune system to treat cancer. And so I thought I would start with these two somewhat provocative, maybe rhetorical questions, because if the answer to these is no, then we should get lunch early and just, you know, quit. But the truth is, I think we now know, and I think Sam put it entirely right, that we don't know the whole picture, but we are learning incrementally in a very important way. We know that the immune system can recognize cancer, and we know that under certain circumstances, the immune system can recognize some kinds of cancer. But for many years, this has really been the conundrum that we, as folks who have thought about how to use the immune system to treat cancer, have struggled with. Because to the immune system, the cancer looks an awful lot like the normal cell that it came from. And we know that from the time of fetal development, the immune system has been trained to ignore self. The nascent lymphocytes are educated in the thymus gland, you know, which is this small gland that sits on top of the heart, to, you know, not recognize self molecules. And that is a way to avoid autoimmunity. And so if something looks a whole lot like a normal cell, there are not going to be high affinity T cells in the immune repertoire that we carry with us for our entire life that recognize self. And so the challenge thrown out to folks who seek to use the immune system to treat cancer is to figure out ways around that. And that's really what we've been doing for a couple of decades now. I think it's always instructive to learn from individual patients. And so I'm going to pepper a little bit of this here and there with lessons that we've learned in the clinic at the bedside that have come back to the benchtop. Because you hear a whole lot about bench to bedside, but you don't hear a whole lot about bedside to bench. And this idea of translational research really is a bidirectional equilibrium that, you know, we are constantly learning in both directions. So this is the story of a 17-year-old young man who came to Memorial Sloan Kettering with, back in the mid-70s with melanoma, which is, as many of you know, a very aggressive skin cancer that until very recently and had a very short life expectancy if it spread to distant organs. And indeed, he did show up at the doorstep of Memorial with metastases to several places, the lymph glands in the neck, at the top of the shoulders, and under the armpit. And he was treated with standard therapy at the time, which until actually about 3 years ago looked an awful lot like standard therapy in the modern time. But we've changed that. He got surgery. He got chemotherapy. He got experimental vaccines to try to educate his body to recognize these tumor cells as being something dangerous. And it kept coming back. And then after finally a lung metastasis was removed, it stopped coming back. And this young man is now a middle-aged guy running a sporting goods shop somewhere in the Colorado Rockies. And he comes back to visit us, you know, once every couple of years to make us feel better, because he certainly doesn't need any medical care. But we as a group of scientists, and some of actually my mentors, did a very simple experiment at the time. They said, you know, there must be some reason why this young man's clinical course was so extraordinary. And maybe it had something to do with the fact that he was vaccinated against his tumor, or, you know, an allogeneic tumor. And they actually harvested his own lymphocytes from his peripheral blood, and they had his own melanoma cells that were growing in tissue culture in the laboratory. Did a very simple experiment. Could the lymphocytes from this patient kill his melanoma cells in a cytotoxicity assay, like a chromium release assay? And the answer was yes. And so then the question became why. And so through a worldwide collaboration, through an organization that that actually helps to fund my research, the Ludwig Institute for Cancer Research, investigators from around the world received his lymphocytes and his melanoma cells in an attempt to, honestly, by brute force expression cloning, identify what targets on his melanoma cells were being recognized by his T cells. And through many years of investigation and really good international collaboration, there were several targets identified. The one in red there is a molecule called tyrosinase. And tyrosinase is a normal enzyme that is found in everyone's melanocytes in this room. Okay, we all are of different complexions, but all of us have melanocytes, and all of our melanocytes make tyrosinase. If you're an African-American individual, then your melanocytes make more melanin pigment, but they still have the same tyrosinase, which is the enzyme that catalyzes the rate-limiting step in the pigment melanin synthesis. If you're an albino, you have tyrosinase, but it's got a point mutation that doesn't allow it to convert tyrosine to melanin. So this is a normal protein, and this young man's T cells learned to recognize that normal protein, and that's why that's in red, because this was sort of an earth-shattering discovery, that a cancer patient's T cells could recognize a normal protein that is present in the malignant counterpart of the cell that normally expresses that protein. So that takes that whole, like, the enemy is thyself, out the door, okay, because it shows that you could overcome this. Now, the other things that we learned were the existence of another normal protein called MART1, and, you know, in science, people can't agree on what to call a protein, and everybody wants to be famous, so they call it different things. So it's called MART1, and some other people call it melan A, depending upon who you know that discovered it, and that's another normal protein, okay? And so another example. The other one, mutated CDK4, tells us something completely different. CDK4, cyclin-dependent kinase 4, very important member of the cell cycle machinery. And mutations in the CDK4 pathway are important in some patients with melanoma. And so now we show that this young man's T cells recognized a mutated protein which is involved in driving proliferation of his particular cancer. And so look at how much was learned by carefully studying one individual patient. We unearthed the idea that the immune system could recognize normal proteins in cancer patients. We discovered a new one, and we actually showed that the immune system could survey the genetic integrity. Okay, lots of people, lots of high-profile papers, but most important, the patient remains free of disease now for over 40 years. So then, we thought about some other observations that were made in the context of melanoma. But these are not limited to melanoma. So melanoma, as I told you, is a skin cancer of the pigment-forming cells in the skin. It can sometimes occur in nevi or moles that all of us have. Nevi are the most common benign tumors in human beings. And sometimes those nevi go wrong. They develop a load of mutations that causes them to become malignant. And that's what a melanoma can look like on the top there. When you go back to your classrooms, you can do a little bit of education on the importance of sun protection and melanoma public awareness, because melanoma is, in fact, in many cases, a preventable disease with good dermatologic care. But that's a bona fide melanoma. It's got a jagged edge. It's not symmetric, and it also has multiple different colors in it. The color in the center is from an area of regression, where the immune system has, in fact, digested the melanoma cells at the center of the lesion. Okay, and so that's an example of how the immune system, left to its own devices, will begin to gnaw away at these cancers, but not completely, because the cancers actually have some ways to suppress the immune system, which I'll talk about later. But that's an example, and then this is another example. This is a gentleman whose normal skin tone is this area here and on his chin. It's a Hispanic gentleman who developed a melanoma on the sole of his foot, which is the area where most darker complexion individuals will develop melanoma. So, fact, Bob Marley actually died of melanoma that arose on the sole of his foot. And so this gentleman, without any treatment, actually began to depigment. He lost all the pigment in his body, but at the same time, all of the melanoma stopped growing. And he actually lived for over 2 years with no therapy because of this immune response that he developed, which couldn't differentiate between the normal melanocytes in the skin, hence they were gotten rid of, and the melanoma cells. He eventually succumbed to the disease, but that was about 4 times the life expectancy that anybody would expect without any treatment. So Sam alluded to the fact that this idea of using the immune system to treat cancer is not a new one. You can go back hundreds of years and see roots of it, but really the first person to think about this quite deeply was this very dashing guy with his arms crossed in the middle of this picture. So a little bit of history. His name is William Coley, and he was the chief of surgery at the New York Cancer Hospital, which was the forerunner of Sloan Kettering. And you can actually see the building where he worked, because it's up on Central Park West, around 100-something Street. There's this old castle-like building there, and that was the original building where he worked. And he was actually thinking a lot about cancer, because surgery was really the only thing that was ever done for cancer, and it was very rarely successful. And so he became frustrated with just summarily cutting off people's, you know, part of people's bodies and having them die anyway. And he began to think about what research questions could be formed. And, you know, this was an area where we knew nothing about molecular biology. We knew nothing about anything at that time. So he didn't have any real lab skills to draw on. He only had powers of observation. Right? And so he used his hands and his eyes, and he said, you know, some people that I operate on live longer than others, and it seems that those who get infections after I do surgery on them live longer than those who don't get infections. And this was the 1890s, and you might imagine that infections after surgery were way more common, because we didn't know about antibiotics, we didn't really know much about microorganisms, we knew a little bit, we didn't know sterile technique, and so this was a very plausible idea, but there was absolutely no proof for it. We didn't know anything about the immune system, but this guy, just based upon these observations, hypothesized that that was the case. He somewhat immodestly developed a therapy which he named after himself, called Coley's Toxins, which was a heat-killed mixture of Serratia and Streptococcus bacteria that he actually brought over from Pasteur's laboratories in France. You know, you couldn't dial up any bio labs and, you know, and get it sent to you. So he had to get on a boat and bring it home. And he injected it into people's tumors, and in fact found that about 30% of people would have regressions if he injected this heat-killed bacterial lysate into people's tumors. And so this carried on for a little while. Park Davis, a drug company, picked it up, and it was used until about the 1930s, when radiation therapy seemed so much more sexy and elegant than heat-killed bacteria. You know, an invisible beam of electrons, right? How cool is that? And so Coley kind of went away and died unceremoniously. But his theories, kind of were never forgotten. And so just a little bit of New York history, you'll see this picture was taken in 1892 at something called the R&C Hospital. So that stands for the Hospital for the Ruptured and the Crippled, which now we more politically correctly call the Hospital for Special Surgery over on the east side. So, okay. So this is one of Coley's patients, actually, that was cured of a sarcoma, a soft tissue tumor on his neck, which was cured by what he called erysipelas, which is cutaneous streptococcus infection into the tumor. And this picture was actually obtained after Coley found this guy living somewhere in the tenements in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. That's how clinical research was done, you know, in the early part of the 20th century. You went and chased down your patients. You know, you didn't send them a portal message, and so this is really the clinical data for the time, and there really were about a third of the people that he treated that were cured. But we never really understood why this worked at a molecular level, and Sam also mentioned another very important person who was one of my mentors, Lloyd Ault, and it really was Lloyd Ault who figured out how Coley's toxins worked. Between about the late 50s and the mid-80s, Lloyd toiled away trying to figure out how the immune system could recognize cancer. And he was enamored with BCG infection. And BCG, as many of you know, is a strain of mycobacteria that's actually used as a vaccine against tuberculosis in the more enlightened countries of the world. We don't use it here. And it's also a bona fide therapy for early bladder cancer. And Lloyd had worked on this in mouse models, and actually actually showed that it had, you know, various different immune modulatory activities. And he developed some systems where he injected mice with BCG, and then about a week or two later, he injected them with an extract of the bacterial cell wall called lipopolysaccharide, or endotoxin. And then he took serum from those mice, or he could take cultured macrophages from those mice, add LPS in a dish, and take the supernatant from those macrophages. And with either of those preparations, he could inject them into a sarcoma, a chemically induced sarcoma, in the back of a mouse, and within a few days, that sarcoma would dry up and fall off and undergo a process called hemorrhagic necrosis. So then the compound was then called tumor necrosis factor in the mid-1980s. And it became one of the first well-categorized cytokines. It also became one of the first recombinant proteins that a company that was very small and unknown at the time, Genentech, produced using recombinant DNA technology. It was brought into cancer therapy, but it proved to be too toxic because in addition to mediating hemorrhagic necrosis, it actually mediates septic shock in humans. And so in one of many examples of the difference between laboratory animals and humans, the dose to induce septic shock in people is almost about the same as the dose to induce anti-cancer activity, but in mouse there's about a 2-log difference. So mice, you have about a 2-log pharmacologic window with which to give tumor necrosis factor that doesn't exist in people. So this never really succeeded as a bona fide therapy for cancer, but it told us oh so much about how the immune system could recognize cancer, and importantly for the skeptics, it began to put some molecular mechanism underlying what was going on from Coley's toxins. And it really brought up the idea of how can we induce immune responses in cancer patients, and the use of medicines and compounds like tumor necrosis factor brings up the possibility of endogenous adjuvants. And adjuvants are things that are used to enhance immune responses. They are what are the vaccines that you get, you know, for flu or pneumonia are mixed with something, some chemical, to make them interesting to the immune system, and those are called adjuvants. And so things that activate the innate immune system, like macrophages, are adjuvants. And so this is sort of an description of different adjuvants and how they can be used. And certainly pathogens by themselves have a number of molecules on their surface that can serve as adjuvants. There are components of the cell wall from the bacteria, the lipopolysaccharide that I mentioned before, which can serve as adjuvants. They can serve as stimuli for something called toll-like receptors, which are on antigen-presenting cells. And those antigen-presenting cells can then make immune hormones like cytokines, which activate T cells. In addition, these same antigen-presenting cells, once they become activated by these different toll-like receptor stimuli, they can actually serve as the vehicle to show things like parts of tumor cells to the immune system. And so the end result is really to go from here to here, where we take a T cell, okay, and we have a peptide, which is a short stretch of the antigen that is trying to be shown to the T cell. And the way that that peptide is shown to the T cell is it undergoes intracellular processing inside the antigen-presenting cell from a full protein. It's chopped up. It's attached to one of the MHC molecules, either class 1 or class 2 molecules, which have as their function showing things to the immune system. It is then recognized by the highly polymorphic and specific receptor on the T cell. And this is sort of like the lock and key interaction. This is what gives T cells their incredible specificity. But this interaction by itself is not enough to get the T cell activated. There need to be other molecules that ligate each other. And one example that I'm going to talk about later as well is the interaction between an activation marker called CD8 CD28 on the T cell and a member of the B7 family of co-stimulatory molecules on the antigen-presenting cell. The fact that not every cell can show a peptide to an activated T cell is what prevents every cell in your body from activating the immune system. It's what constrains antigen presentation to these highly specialized cells and doesn't allow for a whole body response to pieces of self protein. And so with all of that known, so now we know a little bit about adjuvants, things like tumor necrosis factor, pieces of bacteria that can serve as adjuvants. We know a little bit from patients like I told you about of what the targets could be on a cancer cell. Now we know what to make vaccines targeting. Right? We can pick one of those molecules and make a recombinant protein against those molecules. But we're still stuck with the fact that most of those molecules that I told you about are self-molecules or almost identical to self-molecules. And so we still need to somehow fool these T cells into thinking that these targets for cancer vaccination events are not self. And so our group, when I was a fellow in the laboratory, and actually Sam was involved in a support program through the Damon Runyon Foundation that supported some of this work, really came up with a bit of a novel way to fool the immune system into thinking that some of these self-molecules are actually foreign. And that's called xenogeneic immunization. And it's described in this slide. So if you try to take a mouse and immunize it against tyrosinase, as an example, against mouse tyrosinase, nothing will happen. You can use the protein with all kinds of different adjuvants. You can use peptide, protein, whatever you want. Nothing will happen. The mouse will not reject melanoma. The mouse will not develop hypopigmentation. It's just seeing a self molecule. Whatever the adjuvant is not enough to overcome that. But instead of using the mouse version, you use the human version of tyrosinase, and it's a little bit scary to think that we're actually 85% identical to mice. You know, at the amino acid level for most of these proteins, your students might find that amusing. That 15% difference is enough to fool the immune system into thinking that these are foreign molecules and they're dangerous and need to be responded to. But because they're 85% identical, once you overcome that potential energy of antigen recognition, the immune system cannot distinguish very well between them, and you will actually get rid of any cells that bear both the mouse molecule and the human molecule. And so we proved this actually in mice, and we immunized them against a protein in the tyrosinase family called GP75. It's also called, again, with the multiple nomenclature, tyrosinase-related protein 1. And what you can see is if you take a mouse and inject it with mouse melanoma, it's a cell line called B16, after about 2 to 3 weeks, it'll actually grow 200 lung metastases. And if you inject just an empty plasmid vector into the skin of the mouse, nothing happens. If you inject a plasmid that has the mouse GP75 gene, nothing happens. But if you inject a plasmid that tells the mouse's skin cells to now make human GP75, you can reduce that by about 75%. And we actually showed that this is not only true in melanoma, but you can do this similarly in breast cancer with HER2 and in prostate cancer with a relevant antigen called prostate-specific membrane antigen, always requiring a foreign species to overcome tolerance. And the reason, mechanistically, is because of what's shown right here. If you inject a self-antigen, you get nothing, but if instead you inject a mutated antigen, you get tumor immunity, you get autoimmunity, and you can get tumor rejection. And the reason that that happens is because of the peptides that are the pieces of that protein antigen that get shown to T cells. So the wild type peptide, the mouse tyrosinase peptide, does not bind well to the mouse MHC. And so we know that that trimolecular complex, the two chains of the class 1 and the peptide, need to be stable so that the antigen can be shown to the immune system. the heteroclitic or the cross-species peptide binds much better. It stabilizes it. And so therefore, any cells that might be in the repertoire, even if they're not of high affinity, will have a chance to recognize it, they will expand, and they will kill even cells that are bearing the wild-type peptide because they've now been activated. You've changed the balance of power because you've expanded this population of cells significantly so that now there are enough of these to recognize even the shortly lived presentation of wild-type peptide. And so the first clinical example of this approach was actually a series of clinical trials that we did, actually not in people, but rather in dogs with melanoma. And so anybody who's driven down the east side of Manhattan around 62nd Street knows the big white building next to Rockefeller University called the Animal Medical Center of New York, which is the largest tertiary care hospital for pets in the entire world. They actually have a comprehensive cancer center there where they radiation, chemotherapy, surgery for dogs, cats, ferrets, weasels, whoever you know that gets cancer. And so in about the year 2000, I became acquainted with the chair of oncology there, who was a bright young guy that had just gotten his PhD, actually, at MD Anderson. And he taught me that dogs get melanoma. And they actually get it in their mouths, in the pigmented oral cavity. They get it very rarely in the skin, but they sometimes get it in the nail bed. And it's a very bad disease. It actually kills dogs within weeks if it's not taken care of quickly. And the surgery for that is not like having oral surgery on your skin. Like human melanoma patients, dogs have to have their jaw amputated for it. So anything that we could do to help these dogs, because again, these are not laboratory animals, these are people's pets, and they're getting cancer for the same reason that people do, because of the interaction between their genes and their environment. So it's a very valid setting in which to do clinical research. And so we made the same hypothesis that, you know, dog is about halfway between mouse and human. And so maybe if you use this cross-species approach, you could help some dogs. And so we did that, and actually one of the first dogs that we treated with human tyrosinase vaccine actually underwent a complete regression of lung metastases. This is a chest x-ray with the arrows pointing at lung metastases, which went away in this dog. This dog ended up living about 2 years and died of an unrelated cause. And then actually we got into a large-scale clinical trial all over the country. We partnered with a pharmaceutical company to develop this vaccine as a bona fide therapy for dogs with melanoma, and this was the two cohort studies of controls or vaccinates of dogs with melanoma that was actually published about 4 years ago and showed a tremendous difference in survival between dogs that got the vaccine. And so this was actually the first therapeutic cancer vaccine approved in the U.S. And it actually came from us. And so this is my partner, Phil Bergman, who is the veterinarian who developed this with one of his patients. And then that's actually the product. It's a DNA vaccine. So it's plasma DNA that gets injected into the subcutaneous tissue or the muscle of a dog using a needle-free device, which keeps the dogs and the owners happy. So it was a nice example of how we can immunize. Turns out that type of immunization is not potent enough for people, because we did do a clinical trial on people. We could show that injecting mouse DNA into people is safe and can induce short-lived immune responses, but they weren't enough. The human is a tougher nut to crack, and so we had to think more deeply about other approaches. And one of the approaches that we thought about was being unearthed really by a colleague at Washington University, Robert Schreiber, who was working with my mentor, Lloyd Auld, at the time, to think about something called immune surveillance of cancer. And so this was not a new theory. It actually was first proposed by Lewis Thomas and McFarland Burnett in the 1950s. But then it kind of went out of favor. And then in the 90s, with the availability of genetically engineered mice, Schreiber and Auld actually proved this was true. And they actually proved that in mice, at least, cancer could be eliminated with the immune system, or the cancer could go into somewhat of an equilibrium with the immune system where it wasn't spreading, but it wasn't being eliminated. And then there can be escape, where the immune system can be jazzed up to recognize the cancer, but the tumor just gets the upper hand. And so recognizing that there are these three phases that were documented to be true in mice, we now thought about how we needed to amplify all of these, or suppress them in the case of escape in people. Now, the experiment that Schreiber did, which showed, actually, that this was true, was quite elegant. He used mice that were wild-type, and these were the 129 SBEV mice, and they're just wild-type mice, or genetically similar counterparts, but that were what are called RAG2 deficient. So RAG2 deficient mice cannot make antibody or T-cell responses. They don't contain the cellular machinery to rearrange the antibody and T-cell receptors. And so they cannot thus mount an antibody or T-cell response. And so what Schreiber did is he induced chemically, using chemicals, he induced tumors into the skin of these mice, either the wild type or the RAG2, and then cross-transplanted them. So if you take 129 SBEV tumors, okay, and put them into a RAG2 recipient, an immune-suppressed recipient, they grow beautifully, which is what you would expect. If you take tumors that were induced in the immune-suppressed mouse and put them in the immune-suppressed mouse, they grow beautifully. That's a control. If you take tumors that are raised in the wild-type mouse, the normal mouse, and put them into the immune-suppressed host, they grow beautifully. So far, no big surprises. But if you take tumors that were raised in the immune-suppressed animal and transplant them into a wild type, they regress. They regress because those tumors, the RAG2 tumors, never got a chance to be edited by the immune system. They were never subjected to elimination. And so they contain low-hanging fruit for the immune system to recognize. And so when you put them into a mouse that has a competent immune system, they're rejected. And so that really proved to even the most critical skeptics that immune surveillance was true. But what about these escape mechanisms? What do we know about them? Well, we know that tumors can exploit a lot of important immune physiology to maintain their own existence. And so there are, of course, ways that T cells that recognize the self molecules on the cancer are either subjected to ignorance or deletion, and we talked about that from the thymic selection before. But then there are other immune pathways that turn off the immune system once it gets activated, and I will tell you about how one of those is exploited by tumors. And then tumors have the ability, and Sam and I were talking about this before we started, to attract populations of suppressive immune cells into the tumor microenvironment, either suppressive T cells called regulatory T cells or suppressive myeloid cells, which are called myeloid-derived suppressor cells. And tumors preferentially attract these things into their little microenvironments to help them avoid immune detection. How do we know that this is true? Well, this is just one example. It's a particularly nice example of some work done by an MD PhD student in my lab about 6 or 7 years ago named Gabby Rizzuto. And she said, this is a very simple experiment. I'm going to implant B16 melanoma tumors into the skin of an immune-competent mouse, and then after X number of days, I'm going to remove those tumors, and I'm going to look at them by flow cytometry to see what the cellular population inside the tumor is over time. Okay, so we're just going to walk through this from day 4 to day 8, and then from 8 to 10, 12, 14, and 17. So the top one, anyone here has done flow cytometry as part of your lab experience? So flow cytometry is a very sophisticated way to measure single cells, one at a time, that have particular markers on them. And basically the way that it works is you take a little tube with the cells in it, it gets sucked into a device that's basically a chain of lasers. lasers, and the laser shines on each cell one at a time, and if the cell has a fluorescent marker from an antibody that is bound to whatever the protein is you're trying to detect, the laser will pick that up. And so now you can actually simultaneously measure a dozen or more different markers on individual cells one at a time. And then you can actually look at the populations. And so all I want to show you here is that this is dynamic. It's changing over time. So this is looking at CD3 cells, which are T cells, on the x-axis, and NK cells, which are natural killer cells. Sorry, this is the x-axis, and the y-axis, the NK cells. And you can see how this population changes over time. It goes up and then it goes down of natural killer cells. And then if you look at the T cells, you can see it also goes up, but we don't know what kind of T cells those are. If you look at CD4 cells, which are helper T cells, and CD8 cells, which are killer T cells, you can see that they go up and then come down in terms of the killer T cells. And the CD4 cells, again, they generally go down over time. Now, if we look at this population here, this marker is called FOXP3, and it's a transcription factor that marks suppressive T cells. And if you look at baseline, there's about 15% suppressive T cells in the tumor on day 4. By day 10, okay, this is already 55%. That is just within a few days what the tumor does to attract these suppressive cells. And then this is looking at myeloid-derived suppressive cells. Again, by day 8, 57% of the cells are myeloid-derived suppressor cells. And so this shows us how dynamic this tumor microenvironment is and how the tumor automatically enriches for these suppressive cell populations. It gives you an idea for all of the things that we have to overcome in trying to treat patients with immunotherapy. Now, we have had some successes. There is a medicine called interleukin-2, which is an immune system hormone. It was actually discovered by some researchers at the National Institutes of Health who were actually trying to grow HIV in the laboratory in the 80s, and they noticed that there were some things being spit out by their host cells that seemed to make T cells grow better, and one of those things that was spit out into the culture soup was a hormone that we now know as interleukin-2. And again, through recombinant DNA technology, IL-2 was produced and infused into a variety of different cancer patient types, and it actually cures about 3 to 5% of patients with melanoma and slightly more with kidney cancer. But it's a very, very toxic therapy, but it shows that when properly tuned, the immune system can in fact reject cancer, because this blue line here shows by its very, very obvious horizontal nature that patients who are alive at 2 years are still alive 10 years later. And this isn't a disease that had at the time a median life expectancy of 6 months. So IL-2, and so this is just, you know, one of the more prestigious publications of the use of IL-2, came around in 1985. But I want to go back to something that I mentioned before, and that was how T cells get activated. Okay, so we talked about how the T cell receptor sees that peptide bound to the MHC antigen, and how that interaction can lead to T cell activation when the antigen-presenting cell shows things to the T cell. But this is not enough to get the T cell activated. Right? You need that other signal, which was CD28, the activation marker. And on that other slide, this molecule was called B7, again with the multiple names, because everybody wants to be famous. And so when these two things happen at the same time, then the T cell gets activated, it actually makes its own IL-2, and you get a productive immune response. This is what happens when you have the flu and your T cells recognize flu virus. They get all juiced up, and then they start to turn off, and that's when you start to feel better. And the reason that you start to feel better is because the immune system has a series of checks and balances. There are things that turn it on, but there are also the things that turn it off. Now, you might imagine, why on earth would the immune system need something to turn it off? It needs to because if the immune system runs rampant, the these hormones that it produces can actually kill people. And it can actually produce autoimmune disease. And in fact, the T cells can be extinguished if they're too hyperactivated. And one of the critical molecules that's involved in turning T cells off is this little orange fork up here. It's called CTLA-4, cytotoxic T lymphocyte antigen 4. And CTLA-4 normally resides inside the cell. Once the T cell gets activated, it actually translocates into this immunologic synapse. And what it does there is it binds to these molecules that have three different names, okay? And by doing so, it prevents these molecules with three different names, these co-stimulatory molecules, from binding to their activation molecules. So they are very high affinity decoys that prevent that second critical step that T cells need to be activated. And in fact, in addition to serving as decoys, this molecule, once it binds to this family of molecules, generates a stop signal into the T cell. So it's got two ways of turning off T cells. And it does so very effectively. And so in the mid-1990s, one of my former colleagues, Jim Allison, who at the time was working at Berkeley, theorized that if you could temporarily block that molecule, you would allow for a period of more robust immune activation, and perhaps that would be enough to get the immune system to respond to cancer. And so the tool that he used to try to block CTLA-4 was an antibody, an immune protein that he raised at the time in hamsters, actually. And that antibody, the CTLA-4, eventually went on to be a drug which we now call ipilimumab, which I'm going to tell you a little bit about. Now, in explaining this to your students, if you choose to, the analogy to use would be the activation of an immune response is like starting your car. Okay? We know that you have to stick in the key and turn it, and that's the lock and key of the T-cell receptor recognizing antigen MHC. But that is not enough to get the car moving. In order to get the car moving, you need to have that activation molecule and T-cell bind to this, which is the family of molecules with three names, and that's like the gas. Now, we all know that if you've got a car with the ignition on and you sit on the gas, it's going to go fast for a while, and then bad things will happen unless you have a brake, right? And so CTLA-4 is the brake. And what we're doing with this medicine is temporarily, for about 2 weeks or more, cutting the brakes on T cells that allow them to activate to a greater extent than physiology would normally determine. Now, we got a very good idea that this approach could work from some patients that we treated and that other folks treated. And so this is a lady who I actually treated in 2006 who had melanoma tumors that covered the entire surface of her left thigh there. And she also had a very large pelvic lymph node, which you can't see because it's inside her body. And within 6 weeks of getting this treatment, which is an outpatient treatment, one dose every 3 weeks, all of those lumps and bumps went away, okay? And so did the mass in her pelvis as well. But you might see that there are still some pigmented areas on that post-treatment picture. And so we wanted to know, well, why didn't those go away completely? And so we did a biopsy of those areas, and we actually found on histology, the pathologist told us that there were macrophages in that biopsy, there were lymphocytes in that biopsy, but there were no tumor cells. And the reason that they looked darker, why they looked like melanoma from the pigment, is because the pigment from the dead melanoma cells was trapped inside the immune cells. We caught the immune system in the process of eating the dead melanoma debris. Okay, and that lady's thigh has remained sort of tattooed with that dead melanoma pigment for the last 8 years. And actually, she is a retired New York City public school teacher who is now enjoying her retirement now that her melanoma is behind her. And we also looked at what immune cells were there as well, and we saw, if you look at what's staining red there, those were all activated killer T cells in that biopsy, as well as a smaller number of activated CD4 helper T cells. And what this showed us in a very visual way is that medicine, ipilimumab, that blocks the break, did exactly what Dr. Allison designed it to do, which was to replace a growing tumor with a population of activated immune cells which got rid of the tumor. I didn't plan this, but actually this is another high school teacher from Far Rockaway, actually. So I don't want you to go out of here thinking that every school teacher gets melanoma. Okay, it's not an occupational hazard. Okay, so this just happens to be okay. Another public school teacher who came to me again in 2006, and he had melanoma that had spread to his liver. And this is a CAT scan through the liver, and these darker spots are melanoma tumors. He had another one in his kidney. He got 4 doses of this medicine, and then his liver looked like that over there. So who thinks that that looks better? No. Okay. Who thinks it looks worse? Okay. I did too. Okay. And so there are more spots. The spots that were there are larger. It just looks bad. So, you know, I got these scans back the day before I saw him. I had rehearsed my little speech. You know, I'm sorry, Mr. So-and-so, the treatment isn't working. We're going to have to try something else. And so this particular patient is a little bit outspoken also. I guess that's a good skill to have. And so he said, wait, don't tell me what the picture showed. I have to tell you something first. I feel better. Okay, so I said, well, tell me why you feel better, because the pictures really don't substantiate that. And in fact, I had made sure that I looked at the right person's pictures, because based on this, he should have not felt better. And he said, well, you know, I had these fevers every night and they went away, and I had these sweats every night and they went away, and my liver used to hurt when I went to bed every night. I could lie down and feel it, and now that's gone. And so it really was kind of one of those aha moments where I thought to myself, well, maybe you're not supposed to get better at week 12, right? That's to say that the rules that we use to judge when people improve from chemotherapy are applicable to immune therapy. Because again, we're not giving these medicines to the tumors. These medicines are going into the patient's immune system, and then the immune system may at different points in time become activated and recognize different antigens that may make these things look bigger, or may in fact just look bigger because the tumors are not full of more melanoma cells, but perhaps they're full of more immune cells, and a CAT scan can't distinguish that. And so we made a somewhat heretical suggestion to him that he go home and do nothing. And, you know, that was 2006. There were no better therapies. He had already had chemotherapy at the time. So, you know, he was amenable to that suggestion. He came back 8 weeks later, and that's what his scan looked like on the bottom left and then on the bottom right. And so he is now in a complete remission for almost eight years. September will be the 8th anniversary of you know, when we asked him to wait that little bit. And so we learned an awful lot, again, from single patients by trying to remember the science and fit that science into clinical medicine. And, you know, we I think, influenced the way that people think about immunotherapy. Now, not everybody responds to treatment as well as those two patients did. In fact, this particular approach only benefits about 20% of people with advanced melanoma. Now, that's 20% of a few thousand people a year in the country that would have unfortunately succumbed to the disease. But still, it's a call out to do better or do different things. And so one of the things that Dr. Allison, actually this was a slide that he gave me, theorized was that by blocking CTLA-4, what you're doing is you're allowing the tumor to essentially act as an endogenous internal vaccination event. And you're amplifying the immune responses which are going on because of whatever prior treatment the patient had that released some debris, necrotic death of tumor cells, or if you gave the patients, you know, vaccines, or if the chemotherapy again released some debris, or if the tumor cells just grew too big that they outstripped their blood supply and there were areas of what are called necrosis. Whatever you did to try to expose some antigens, you would now amplify that with this treatment. And so we began to think about different combinations of treatment. And again, single patients telling us a lot. This is a lady who had metastatic melanoma, again, and the melanoma tumor is up by that white arrow, up on top there. It's in the back of her lung. And then there's some enlarged lymph glands in her chest. This black arrow is pointing to just an abnormal blood vessel in her liver. So that's not cancer. And then this red circle is drawn around her spleen, just for reference. Okay, so August 2009, she begins ipilimumab. That tumor, the major one in the back of her lungs, over the course of about a year and a half, begins to enlarge. But remember, this is a disease that, before this drug, led to people's deaths between 7 and 9 months after diagnosis. So already she's doing okay, but not well enough. Because that tumor with the white arrow got bigger, this is still there, this we didn't expect to change, but now she's developing these little spots in her spleen. Okay, so looks like the treatment is not working and she's getting new disease. And in fact, that big tumor in the back of the lung is beginning to put pressure on the nerves exiting the spine. And so we asked one of our radiation oncologists to design a radiation field, and this is the planning film from her radiation. The highest dose just given to that tumor in 3 doses of radiation to try to just help her with the pain. Now, in fact, it did help her with the pain. And right after the radiation was done in January, we could see really no difference. Our big tumor is still there. Maybe it's a little bigger. There's more disease in the spleen. The lymph nodes look a little larger. But then, 3 months after the radiation, something very cool happened. Okay? Not only did the tumor that got irradiated go away, which we kind of expected that it would get smaller because radiation can be effective sometimes, but these lymph glands shrank and the spleen cleared out. And it has stayed that way. And the idea really is that the radiation event to that one tumor made that tumor into a vaccination site. And whatever gook was inside that vaccination site as a result of the radiation became interesting to the immune system. And we continue to give her the immunotherapy as well, and she remains well. We actually showed, using a multiplex technology that measures antibody responses to 9,000 human antigens simultaneously, that if we compare the antibodies in her blood before the radiation to after, the radiation resulted in 10 new antigenic targets being recognized by her immune system. And so it was an example of how we could bring different technologies together. Now, there are other therapies for cancer based upon identification of important signaling pathways that induce proliferation in cancer cells. And in melanoma, the so-called MAP kinase pathway, the mitogen-activated protein kinase pathway, is very important. And it's important because more than half of melanomas have a mutation in a gene called BRAF, R-A-F, which is conserved and in about half of melanomas and drives their proliferation, and they're very good inhibitors that block BRAF that cause temporary regressions in melanomas that have the BRAF mutation. Not all of them last for a long time. In fact, most only last a few months. So we thought that this was an interesting thing to combine with immunotherapy, and so in a mouse model of melanoma that has the V600E mutation, we combined a BRAF inhibitor with immunotherapy together, and in fact showed that mice that got the BRAF inhibitor plus the anti-CTLA-4 did better than either of the control groups. Now, when based upon the success of anti-CTLA-4, there is now renewed interest in the immune system for cancer. And the other molecule that has become very well known as an immune checkpoint that restrains the immune system is called PD-1. And you may have read in the newspaper there's a lot of interest in PD-1 right now as a target for immunotherapy. So PD-1 is an abbreviation for a molecule with an unfortunate name. PD-1 stands for programmed death. Okay, so when explaining this to your patient, you might imagine that this is not, in fact, the most attractive name for a cancer patient, but nonetheless, it's an important pathway. And PD-1 normally is expressed on T cells, and it marks cells that have been activated and are now exhausted. And the molecule that PD-1 binds to, there are two of them. One of them is called PD-L1, PD ligand 1, and the other one is called PD-L2. And they really serve as interactions that turn off the T cell. And the normal physiology of this is that the dendritic cell, the antigen-presenting cell, is what expresses the ligands to turn off the T cell once it becomes activated. Now, tumor cells, in a very elegant example of how they can corrupt normal immunity to protect themselves, have learned to express this molecule, PD-L1, on their surface. So imagine you're a tumor cell, and there's a cytotoxic T cell barreling at you. What better way to protect yourself against that T cell than to have on your surface the molecule that actually causes death on impact of the T cell? And that is what many different cancers have learned to do. And so as you might imagine, there's now great interest in antibodies that block PD-1 and that block PD-L1. And one of those antibodies is called nivolumab. So again, with the transportation analogies, if you're explaining this to your students, the same way that CTLA-4 is the brake, PD-1 is like the emergency brake. It's death on impact, right? The train comes to an immediate halt. And so this really is an important way to get the lay public to understand what these molecules really do. And so in the initial clinical trials of PD-1 blockade, using an antibody, now we know it's nivolumab, in patients with melanoma, we saw evidence of clinical activity. And so each one of these lines is an individual patient, and their tumor burden is graphed on the y-axis. So if it's in the negative, it means it's getting better, going down, and that's time on the x-axis in weeks. And so you can see there are a substantial number of patients whose tumor burden goes down. Now, interestingly, just like that patient who has liver metastases I showed you, there are some people with this therapy who get worse and then who get better. And in fact, there are some people who get better but develop new tumors along the way that eventually regress and have a complete response. And so this idea that the kinetics of response are different for immunotherapy is upheld here. Now, I talked a lot about melanoma, and in fact, immunologists have been interested in melanoma for a long time, I believe for a lot of reasons. One is a self-fulfilling prophecy, really, because melanoma was thrown to the immunologists early on as a disease to try to tackle because nothing else worked. And so we know a lot more about melanoma than we know about other cancers in terms of the immunology. We also know that melanoma can rarely, but sometimes, have documented instances of spontaneous remission. And if you exclude divine intervention, immunology is probably the best explanation for spontaneous remission. But the world really changed with PD-1 because PD-1 looked to be so effective that it was actually tried in other cancers. And this is an example of patients with advanced, relapsed lung cancer who have been through chemotherapy, surgery, radiation, whatever else is commonly used. And about a third of these patients with advanced lung cancer had durable responses to PD-1 blockade, which all of a sudden alerted the oncology community, and in fact, the scientific community, the fact that immunotherapy could be real. It's not a niche intervention for a rare disease like melanoma, but it could conquer a very commonly observed cancer like non-small cell lung cancer, which actually is a very virulent cancer. So this is another of the PD-1 antibodies. This is, again, a melanoma. Patients treated with a drug called pembrolizumab, which is a PD-1 blocking antibody, showing that, in fact, about 72% of people can have some degree of disease control with this PD-1 blocking antibody. We've actually combined the two approaches together, the CTLA-4 and the PD-1 blockade together, because PD-1 blockade, as I told you, could operate not just in the local draining lymph node where T cells are activated by antigen-presenting cells, but also in the tumor microenvironment. And so when we combine these two things together in the laboratory, in a mouse model of colon cancer, you can see that the combination is more effective than either one alone. And then in melanoma, again, we can see that the combination is more effective than either one alone. And then in people, we saw degrees of response that we had never witnessed before. We saw, using doses that we now consider optimal for the combination, that more than half of patients will have these dramatic responses by the first time we looked. And in fact, this is a patient who had all of these different tumors that were gone by 12 weeks. Each tumor is represented by an orange arrow up there. And if we look at the aggregate reduction, the best response the patients had, we had about 20% of patients who had a complete disappearance of all tumor, and we had about another 20% who had close to that. And this, again, in a disease that was considered highly refractory to therapy until very recently. So we think about 2/3 of patients will have their disease controlled just with immunotherapy in the context of melanoma. And if we look at how long people are living, which is, I think, the most important metric, the 2-year survival in the group of patients treated that we consider to be the optimal doses is 88%. As recently as 2010, the 2-year survival for similarly staged patients with melanoma was about 10 or 15%. So we've made a lot of progress in a short period of time, and it's really been the basic science of immunology that's driven these interventions. This shows you the whole population. Okay, I'm just going to tell you about 2 or 3 other approaches, and then we'll be done. One of them is a molecule called GITR, which is an activating marker on T cells. It's a member of the TNF receptor family. And what GITR by itself, as a single intervention in a mouse model, can actually cure about half of mice by itself. And the way that it does that, quite interestingly, is by changing that suppressive T cell population inside the tumor. It changes the lineage commitment of those T cells to take them away from the suppressive phenotype and move them to an effector phenotype, showing that these cells have a reversible kind of path of differentiation, and they can be reprogrammed with immunotherapy. Another one of these molecules is actually called OX40. It's expressed on regulatory cells as well as effector cells. And with an antibody to OX40 called OX86, we actually can cure 100% of mice with advanced melanoma. These are large tumors you can see up on the top there. Not by itself, but when given with a modest dose of chemotherapy and an infusion of T cells that were grown outside the laboratory. So that's a very striking result. And we actually showed that those T cells have a quite potent killer phenotype. Another approach, which is being spearheaded by a fellow, now faculty member, in my laboratory, actually Sam, another Damon Runyon awardee this year, named Dimitri Zamarin, takes advantage of those pattern recognition receptors that we talked about, how bacteria and viruses can get the immune system activated. And so Dimitri works with something called an oncolytic virus, so oncocancer-lytic lysis, and these are viruses that, because of the differential effects on cells that have high cycling, they can actually kill some cancer cells. And Newcastle disease virus is actually a bird virus, so people are not usually exposed to it. There is not a lot of pre-existing immunity to this virus because of that. And in fact, it can kill some tumors, and it can be injected into people safely. What Dimitri actually showed is that if you take a mouse and implant a tumor on each flank of the mouse, and if you inject the tumor with Newcastle disease virus, the injected tumor will regress. The distant tumor, the non-injected tumor, will actually grow. But if you look at the immune cells inside the distant tumors, what you can see is that as opposed to a control animal, there is a high induction of CTLA-4 high T cells into that non-injected tumor. And in fact, you can then go on and treat those mice with anti-CTLA-4 after the Newcastle disease and cure about 3/4 of them. Because you have actually caused infiltration of the non-injected tumor with immune cells. The only tumor that will reliably regress is the one that gets the virus injected into them. But because of all the inflammation induced by the virus, which causes production of interferon and other cytokines, the non-injected tumor will become inflamed. And so you can imagine if you've got a patient whose cancer is not necessarily responding to immunotherapy, if you could just make one of those tumors inflamed, inject the virus into them, and then continue to give the immunotherapy, perhaps they will all regress. And so that is an approach that we're now looking at. Now, Sam mentioned before about Dr. Rosenberg at the National Cancer Institute, who pioneered what's called adoptive transfer of T cells. And this is really like a big orchestra of different approaches all put together. And what they've done is, in some cases, they've removed the tumor from the patient. They have purified the T cells out of the tumor, expanded them by culturing them in the presence of antigen and cytokines outside the body, and then reinfused those T cells into the patient after the patient's own immune system has been suppressed with either high doses of chemotherapy or high doses of radiation. And when that's done, sometimes they can get very striking results. You can see here, day 34 after treatment, livers have cleared out of melanoma. Now, this is not a treatment for everybody because people can become quite sick because of the high doses of chemotherapy and radiation. But it does show that if you properly cultivate immune cells outside the body and prepare the body to receive them, those immune cells can actually take root, can kill their target, and can actually eradicate the cancer in a fraction of patients. And so we're now thinking about how to bring all these different tools together. And that's all I wanted to say. Yeah.